Welcome to Education Fast Forward. This is our seventh meeting. Today it's about quality and access to education. We have 18 centres around the world in 11 countries and many different time zones. And I'm going to hand straight over to Vera Cabral in Sao Paulo, who's going to set the scene for today's discussion. Vera?
Hello, everybody. This is a very important discussion. We are today talking about access and quality, and it's an important issue to the whole world.
Welcome to everybody, and please tweet your comments, as I say, and your questions. Those questions and those comments will either be picked up in the discussion or later on when we put all the information together at the end of the event. We also have 18 telepresence units around the world in 11 countries. The countries are Australia, Brazil, Canada, France, Hong Kong, India, Portugal, South Africa, United Arab Emirates, and the UK and USA. So really covering the whole world, and we'll be people in those telepresence units will be contributing to the debate and also using WebEx in the background to share information.
But it's also about fostering a culture that moves away from qualifications, education up front, handing out certificates to young people, towards actually making lifelong learning a reality for all. That's the biggest challenge in front of many of our societies, particularly in the context of rapidly aging economies.
First of all, I think the first step is, and I mentioned complacency in the beginning, the first step is we've got to overcome what I see as real complacency in terms of global activity around education, a perception that because there's been a significant increase in enrollment over the last decade, that the work is largely done in education. But the work is far from done in education. We need a recognition that education is indeed everyone's business. It's not only the business of ministries of education, as important as they are. It requires more engagement by government across the board, ministers of finance, ministers of health, ministers of education. It also requires partnerships outside of schools, partnerships with education, but broader partnerships with the community, partnerships with businesses, working with employers and business leaders, as well as education specialists. Education is everybody's business.
In a recent study that was also done in Germany, conducted by a consultancy firm called EGRA and EGMA, and they've assessed the literacy skills of students in the early grades, and they've correlated that with their performance in mathematics, and they found that there was an immediate correlation and that there is a problem with literacy at the early grades, and that's leading to poor math skills. And this year we've had the qualitative standpoint looking at Jordan STEMS results, and it's not a secret that it has declined over the past few years. And this is a big part of the reason for that is the literacy.
One has to look at core skills. Now, for instance, there is this obsession in India with skilling unskilled people, or the unskilled graduates, as Andrea's talking about. And a lot of people are finding that even after the skilling, you find you're really not getting your money's worth, because core attitudes, positive attitudes towards work, towards learning, are missing. So what are these attitudes? And what we've found is you've got to disseminate this or stimulate a spirit of inquiry. Curiosity, creativity, and confidence are probably foundational sort of attitudes that can help you acquire skills as you go through your life. And in terms of access, we have some very low-cost ways of doing it. We use mobile labs and so on. And as a gentleman from the UAE was saying, clearly technology can play a role. We shouldn't overestimate its impact in education at this point in time. We're running something called a blended classroom, and the results are quite interesting.
Thank you.
you know, for too long, we and there are lots of many different we's, academics, teachers, school heads, systems, ministries, have sort of pretended that if you go through this set of qualifications, you will get a job. And I was struck by Heif when he was talking about youth unemployment in where he is. But many countries of Europe have huge youth unemployment, and take Spain, for example. And I think here in the UK, we've pretended to a generation of people, maybe more generations, that actually this qualification will be of some use. And we're not giving them kinds of skills. And I don't agree that business should lead. I don't agree it's just employment skills. It's all this wider sort of strength of experiences they need to have.
I would strongly agree with Tim that, as you know, I've been an education minister, so some of it's my fault. And I've also been an employment minister trying to pick up the pieces of my mistakes. And certainly...
So he's blaming you.
Thank you, Tim.
So she didn't go to health in the end.
And certainly I think it would be a mistake if others around the world followed the Western model, because it's a model that I think certainly fails about a third of children. And we need to look at a pedagogy that fits a post-industrial world, because we're still stuck in the industrial one. And it's one that, in part, also needs to embrace enterprise. Because when I look at the economy, and I don't want to be overly utilitarian about it, I think Andreas's presentation was very useful in having us also look at the needs of the economy as well as the needs of individuals. That economy obviously is moving away from large mass workplaces. It's moving towards more employment, more growth coming from smaller enterprises. And so we need to inculcate more enterprise within education. Now, that involves risk-taking. And risk-taking in education, when we have such high-stakes accountability and when we have the delights of PISA measuring our national systems, when education ministers like me have testing and tables driving everybody to distraction, we have a very risk-averse system. And I think we need to rebalance our education systems so that we can, yes, take advantage of technology, but first and foremost, make room for innovation.
Actually, I think that Hong Kong has been fairly successful in terms of access and quality, because we have been ranking quite high in the PISA. And I feel that we have been discussing is about better skills, better jobs, and better lives. But I feel more importantly, as one of the members have already mentioned, is really the attitudes. If we got the right attitudes, everything will work out. We will have to work hard and work smart, and, you know, and generate the kind of skills, you know, that is required. I think the generic skills are important, you know, to develop in all the students.
Ministers have a tendency not to understand the complexity of policymaking and moving something from one place to another place. There's a super book out last year by Nancy Cartwright and Jeremy Carter called, I think it's called Education Decision Making, A Practical Guide. It's OUP. Every minister all over the world should read it to understand the complexities and the subtleties of moving things from one domain to another domain.
I actually must say, I very much agree with the idea that we need to think beyond formal education in school. You know, the idea that we grind everybody through the same mill and get the kind of, it's not just about quality, it's about relevance of learning, relevance of education for individuals and for society. I mean, I want to challenge, actually, I think it was Haif from Dubai, who basically was saying, look, we're not doing well on reading in maths, and that's why we have all of this unemployment. You know, the people who are unemployed in your countries are actually highly qualified. They have gone through lots of years of education. at least a large fraction of them. And I think that's what we need to rethink. What are the, how do we create a better match between the kind of skills that drive our societies forward and how we deliver this those skills in very basic setting? Education for all doesn't mean to get everybody through the same old model of school, but it means to bring learning to the learner. That's really sort of my main take on that.
I think the professional education field is probably one of the least risk-taking fields ever. And we have got to get education out of the hands of the educrats. I mean, ministries of education to be involved, and I appreciate we have former ministers of education, yeah. But their leadership capacity in terms of something that is less traditional, a broader set of ways of interventions, the leadership isn't there, and we need more diversity. We need a broader community driving education.
And I do think that we need to really make education freer of that bureaucracy so that people can take risks. Teachers are creative and they can be creative. What we need to do is how we make policymakers work with students, work with teachers, and work with industry, as Carol talked about, partnerships. And really look at then how do we scale that? How do we then take that policy, put it into practice and scale it? Because that's the biggest problem we have, is how do we make it scale? And where have we seen, and maybe either Andreas or Carol can answer that, where have we seen places where the scaling has worked and made an impact? Because you've got a few countries and a few areas in that top right-hand quadrant, Andreas. What have they done? How have they made it work? And is it universal?
What technology can do for us is help us develop networks and communities of practice where networks and communities of practice haven't already existed.
Who decides what goes on and what is quality education? I mean, is quality education just being able to read or add and subtract, or is it being able to learn and apply what you learn into your marketplace, into your job, and reflecting it on the economy? So to me, this is quality. It's a matrix that you have to judge quality by.
Europe is sort of a great example for this. You can actually almost divide the countries. You know, there are some countries with high youth unemployment, others low youth unemployment. When you look at this carefully, you'll actually see that the countries with low levels of youth unemployment tend to be those that have where the education system has understood that people learn differently and they're actually able to embrace that diversity. They usually have combined work-based programs as well as academic programs, and the boundary between them is not as sharply divided. It's not that you have to push young people to make choices, you know, either go to university or you go to learning at the workplace, but where sort of learning at the workplace allows people to develop sort of soft skills on modern equipment. You know, it's about creativity. It's about problem solving, working with others. And at the same time, where employers do a lot to actually help people to develop the kind of academic skills. If you look towards specific countries, you know, Switzerland is doing a great job in this. Germany is doing a great job in this. This is where the solutions are actually systemic. Employers are making not just a contribution in terms of hiring some apprentices, but they're actually making a contribution to the design and the implementation of the education system. And that's really what you need to write in. But there are good examples for this. They exist in Europe. Singapore is a good example that has actually sort of made a switch. You know, past they had basically academic education was revered as the only road to success. If you go to Singapore now, some of the most prestigious colleges are that provide a lot of enterprise-based and vocational education. So I think actually there are good systemic solutions.
Yeah, my point is the point about entrepreneurship is excellent, because if you take a country like India, which puts in about 15, 20 million people into the workforce every year, there's no way they can be employed by any industry. You know, there just aren't that many jobs in the organized sector. So the majority of these graduates or the people who come into the workforce are going to have skills that are going to enable them, or have to have skills that are going to enable them to employ themselves or create jobs, not seek jobs. And that's the point I wanted to make. Thank you.
We've been really pleased to see the emergence of both learner voice and the discussion on emerging leaders be such a focus in recent debates. And I think with our work at Taking It Global, we've really been working on building out this future-friendly school model that looks at learner voice and student voice as one of the key kind of values that we think that successful education systems will hold in the future. But I guess the question I want to put out there and maybe have a bit more discussion on is when it comes to kind of learner voice and emerging leaders in this discussion around both quality and access, what role do we think that that learner voice and emerging leaders could play, both in terms of developing policy and then in actually helping us implement it as we seek to address both of these issues around the world?
It's not enough for today's students to just know more. They need to be able to do more with what they know. And that's why I'm so impressed by Andre's slide about how skill development accelerates when you creatively combine education and work experience. It really is about understanding how to create a simultaneous learning and work environment. Because in today's world, learning is the work. We used to learn to do the work. Now learning is the work.
I think that when we talk about access and quality being not conflicting goals, as Carol just said, and for our discussion here, we are coming to a point where actually education has to be thought as a different framework. It's not only schools and not only one model of schools, and it's not only the Ministry of Education. And so thinking about quality and access not being conflicting is something broader. So new pedagogies is an element very important, but we have to think institutionally and how we can use technology and tools that are available in order to make this goal of quality and access getting together something real.
You realize we have education systems that have been going on inertia. It's not just a question of, being risk averse. It's also a question of abdicating those decisions to sets of people who, in spite of their best intention, are not equipped to understand the requirements of a new century. So even when you look at traditional knowledge, even as you do something as mathematics, you realize that the people we put in charge of coming up with the recommendations have a very traditional view themselves, because they, in turn, have the confines of their own biases, be they academic environments or what have you, that prevent them from seeing what math could be in the modern world. And for much beyond those who only go to, let's say, four-year universities. That's just taking an example. You can generalize that to other facets of knowledge that are not addressed, be they robotics or synthetic biology or cinematography or whatever. You can generalize that to other dimensions of an education, as was said here and there before by Carol and Andreas and so on, and Hong Kong as well, about the need for skills, not just knowledge. That's the second dimension. We're talking about creativity, communication, collaboration, critical thinking, etc. The necessity for character education, which sometimes gets called values, temperament, behaviors, attitudes, and so on. And by character, we mean initiative, insistence, and so on. And then, if you think about how do we prepare to remain constantly at the forefront, because no one can see in a crystal ball accurately from the get-go what will be needed in the future, there are shorter-term ways of dealing with this, which Anne has alluded to, meaning get the employers involved and get the person themselves involved, which is the second way, meaning metacognition, learning how to learn and being in charge of your own learning throughout your life is in itself a trait that can be imparted and a dimension that school systems, as well as standards, need to pay attention to.
I
I would have thought it might be profitable to discuss systemic ways in which the developed world, through its schooling system and its young people, can contribute to the solution of the 50 million who are out of school in poorer countries. They do that, but we haven't had any debate about it.
I come from a time when education was the process by which people were prepared to be persons. Persons were able to set a goal to themselves and eventually achieve it, and so reach happiness or eudaimonia. Later on, the role of preparing people, the aim of preparing people for being good citizens, was added so we could live together, especially in the liberal democratic society. And now it seems that preparation for work seems to have taken the field, and everything disappears from the scene and becomes education for developing the necessary skills to find employment or becoming an entrepreneur in the digital society. To some extent, if I can say so, I agree with the claim that education is everybody's business. But I do not think schooling or school education is everybody's business. So we are, despite the talk that we need a new paradigm, we keep talking about school education, educational systems, as if that was set in steel, and that we couldn't have education that was provided, say, in informal circles and families and communities through the internet and other technology, etc. So I don't think we can say so confidently that today learning is the work, or that education and education and those that provide jobs are basically doing the in the same boat in doing a work that is equivalent. I think we still have education as preparing the persons to be autonomous, responsible, competent, to live their lives and achieve happiness or whatever. The role of preparing citizens so that we can live in a peaceful society. And work is something that was added on. We need to work in order to sustain ourselves and those that depend on us. But I don't see that governments, for instance, ought to be supporting skill development that will provide employees for Microsoft and for IBM and Google and Cisco, for that matter. Yeah. So I think we ought to say we have a responsibility for our own education, for the education of perhaps our family, our communities, but education for taking jobs in the kind of service or industry that we have today is the responsibility of those that need the employees more than of the whole society.
The one college which Michelle is involved with, I've been involved with, that will be taking students in September, age 14 and 16. And they're going to start not doing their examination courses at 14 for GCSEs, not doing their A-level courses for 16, and doing then some vocational work. They're going to start on curricula and cross-phase projects set up in collaboration with the sponsor companies. So they'll be doing work with Network Rail on organising the concourse of Reading Railway Station. And they'll be working 14-year-olds and 16-year-olds together at doing this. They'll be working in teams. So there's an example of the vision of an institution, a particular college, but working in partnership with the companies, big and small, but using the work experience to drive the skills. I think it was it Tom was talking about, you know, matching the kind of skills to the needs. But also it's by the work experience telling you about the skills that you do need. It's the symbiosis between that. We've got Khan Academy. Kids can go and pick up the video that tells them how to solve equations. It's actually knowing that equations need to be solved.
Yeah, and I think it was definitely a great point about how we could create some kinship and collaboration between students in the developed world and using their voice to support those in the developing world. I think we've seen that in a few different scenarios. A great example is a program called Challenge 2020 that was inspired by Jean-François Richard's book, High Noon, that's connecting schools in the developed world with those in the developing world to work together on solving one of his 20 global problems. And we also tried to kind of put this into practice as we looked at developing this kind of the certification or standard for what a future-friendly school looks like. Rather than pretend that we knew everything, we actually crowdsourced the indicators for how you might measure something like that. And we had over 4,000 participants around the world vote on and suggest on new indicators. So as governments, as policymakers look to actually decide on some of these policies, select the programs that they invest in, you know, looking at more innovative approaches to engaging students and all stakeholders in participating. I think often even in the classroom, teachers feel unheard in some of these policy conversations. So how can we leverage these latest technologies to really drive new levels of citizen participation? And I think we've seen several great examples of students in developed world countries working to hold their governments accountable for the pledges they've made to some of the international cooperation and international aid commitments, like the 0.7 pledge here in Canada, that actually would hopefully provide the resources necessary to drive at the access education conversation. I think we need to do more to kind of empower and inspire that sense of civic participation and leadership. We've seen lots of it around the world, supported by and inspired by social working, and I think we'll see more of it as we support this new role of students leaders in the classroom.
One project which I think is particularly interesting, the Alternative University of Bucharest, which I had the good fortune to speak with some people about recently. In that Alternative University, it takes you through four different stages. The four stages are exploring, action, transition, and mastery. So it's not a subject base. The subject can be whatever you like. You will be supported through that process. Exploring is about discovering the area in which you really want to make your mark. Action is about building your initial portfolio. Transition is about beginning to identify the vehicles by which you might achieve what you want to achieve. And mastery is about becoming a reflective and professional practitioner in the area that you choose. And the point about going through this project, and the reason I want to mention it, is that in that university, what they are doing is you may choose as your vehicle in that transition stage, building social enterprise, or the building of a commercial enterprise, or acting as a freelance. And those sorts of that model where you are bringing education and the world of work, and the world of work is not predefined as going into a job for a major corporation. It's about, it can be, but that's your choice. It can be about a social enterprise, which has nothing to do with going into a job in a traditional sense, but something completely new. I think those sorts of models have a lot to teach us, and I just commend that as an example that people might like to do that.
Hi. Yeah, I'm thinking of a couple of points that tidies up a couple of things. Going back to Hive, he talked about the policy impediments of some governments, and having, like many of you, worked in the Middle East and some of our African and Asian nations, we're still seeing that replication import of other people's education policies to fix up the nations. And that's, we're continuing seeing that learning not for purpose. Where I am seeing learning for purpose, to give a developing country example, so that will marry nicely with South Africa, is in the Philippines. And what I've been fascinated with Philippines is that they have taken technology for purpose and have done so for many, many years. So the use of mobile phones back when there were those tiny little screen boxes were the things that lecturers have been teaching courses for, bachelor's and master's courses for many, many years. I mean, that was 10 years ago. So you can imagine the teaching that's being done in a mobile world in the Philippines now is quite extraordinary, and the length and breadth of that geography. What we're seeing for in learning fit for purpose is some of the examples being used tonight in the developed world. So you will see maths and science being taught, but it's the maths and science of the fishing village. And again, although it's the local purpose of the learning, it's still with quite a sophisticated technology background that we don't see in the developed world sometimes.
And I come from a very, very rural background. And I would really, really like to agree with her on quality, the importance of quality of education and access at the same time. Because you can access the education, but the quality is impaired by either your low participation levels or the student to teacher relation not being there, or even the study environment not being that good. So I really, really agree with Carol. Thank you very much.
How can we tell young people more of the truth of how tomorrow's labour market is going to look like? And there are some countries that are doing quite well on this. New Zealand, the career services system, Australia, Singapore, I mentioned, they actually at least are able to portray what the current skill demand is. It still doesn't answer the question, you know, what is tomorrow, the day after going to look like? We need to sort of also have the longer term perspective, also highlights the importance for education to play a very proactive role. But there are some countries that are much more transparent, or at least to give young people an indication. Because the part of the problem also is that the incentives for institutions are also not right. Often, you know, universities provide the kind of courses that are cheap to provide. It's much easier to educate a lawyer than to educate an engineer. And there are a lot of reasons why sort of the issues are shorted. Young people get misled by what they see in television. You know, media studies, a very famous subject for young people to go to, not great in terms of getting employment or and social life. So telling young people the truth, you know, where's the future likely to be, very important, very hard to do. You mentioned also getting the employers into the picture. How can employers actually find out, you know, what are skills, what is the talent available, where? Very hard to do. The United States, ONET, is an example where at least a good attempt is being made. But in general, we're not very good at that. We can count qualifications, we count certificates, but when it comes to actually what are people actually able to do, it's much harder, because as someone rightly said before, the modern world doesn't reward you for what you know, it rewards you for what you can do with what you know. This is about skills and competences.
A very rich area now is developing to developing. There are lessons to be learned from different countries. Ethiopia has made major increases in access to education and indeed some quality. There are lessons to be learned there that can be shared with other countries. Indonesia has done a great deal of work with, for example, madrasas, and they provide funding for those where the madrasas adopt the entire core curriculum of the country. The Sahel in Africa can learn from that. So one of the things that the global partnership we are trying to do now is to help those who are on the front lines share experiences. Things like teacher training. I'd like us to spend a little bit more time on teachers and quality of training and quality of teachers, because it's just crucial. In the poorest countries, you can't just yank a teacher out of classroom to send them to training, but doing peer-to-peer, again, using technology. So I think there are new ways of doing things. And to conclude, when I was suggesting education is everyone's business, it's not that business takes over education. It's just that there needs to be ownership by everyone.
Wherever we are across the globe, the nature of formal and informal learning environments is changing dramatically. But I want to just call out five things, Gavin, very quickly, where I think we are seeing really big shifts. The first is in the role of government, away from regulator, provider to enabler and broker. The second is in the area of who the new providers are that are coming into the marketplace in very mixed markets now across all of our geographies. The third is on the demand side. And that is, I wouldn't use the word student voice or learner voice. I'd use the word learner agency. It's much more a shift in power. And I know that's different at different age groups. The fourth is technology, which people have talked about. And Carol, you just brought in the question around an expanded workforce. I mean, wherever you go now, having conversations that have shifted the debate across each of those five dimensions, and you hope is going to serve both the improvement and it will be very much part of innovation. Just to give you one example, the second WISE yearbook, Learning Elite, that, of course, many of us are aware of because we were at WISE last year when it was released. Have a look at the 15 examples, and they are certainly not defined in terms of innovation or improvement to particular geographies. It is not a split between developed and developing. It's across all geographies. We can learn from each other in this debate as we are tonight.
We're going through massive debates here in Australia at the moment about the fact that our students come out with no resilience. That they all believe that they're capable of anything and they have no resilience. And all of a sudden there's sort of a backlash that we have to start building in failure to student experiences so that they can start to learn. And I just think that that leads me to say also that there's not just learning for academia. We've got many more students that are completing tertiary courses now than we ever used to from very, very different backgrounds and very different levels of ability. And education's got to be about life, not just the jobs, and certainly not just about getting through exams. So when we're talking about all of these better skills, better jobs, better learning outcomes and better classroom environments, just seems to me that, you know, we're trying to narrow down the debate so that we can talk about some of the issues. But every time we do that, we blow out again and we say, well, you know, what's education for?
You know, we've been working recently on in writing a paper called Pedagogies for Deep Learning, and one of the things in it that seems critical is, and the discussion has tapped into this, that we need to not just focus on kids doing well in the schooling part, but kids doing well for life. Kids flourishing, I think, is the term that that Robinson's used recently. What I would say, and what I'd love to hear more discussion about, is the fact that we seem to be using measures, assessments in education today that have no correlation to what success in life might be. And therefore, if we continue to focus on those measures, I'm sure we're going to get this continual dichotomy between where kids should be and their ability to flourish and a focus on irrelevancy almost. I mean, yes, we want kids to be able to read and write, but surely in this day and age we can do a better job of measuring what it is that they need for success in life. And today, unless we start to address this, I think we're going to be continually going in circles and going back to look at whether they're an A, a B, or a C, or a D, or whatever that means, or whether they're an 87 out of 100.
Those of you who are total anoraks might have picked up that here in the UK there was announced today that a proposal that all 11-year-olds will be assessed and then told, and which grade they are in terms of, yeah, you know, they are at the bottom 10%, the top 10%, or somewhere in between, which I find appalling and astonishing. But it relates to the point that's just been made, and I think assessment has to change. But unfortunately, rightly, schools are being held to be more accountable. But unfortunately, what that then means is that assessment is the tail wagging the dog, and that's then informed teaching practice, which becomes more low-risk because you can't afford to do bad in the assessment. The examination boards are very risk-averse because, you know, they're so high stakes, these assessments, that you can't afford for there to be a problem with them, so you don't innovate in that area either. And you therefore get sort of trapped in a system that was great maybe, I don't know, 20 years ago or earlier, but really isn't fit for purpose anymore.
You mentioned accountability, but it's accountability for who? Is it accountability for the students? And I think if we don't have accountability for the students, then we're perhaps missing the mark. So my question is, who's going to uncover the emperor's clothes, you know, the emperor's new clothes, and say that this assessment regime isn't working for the primary stakeholders, which are the kids in school?
No, it seems to me we're still talking in the paradigm of the traditional education system, and that's what I've been struggling with as we talked about workforce trends and trends toward the need for modern learning. You know, I still, as a traditional educator myself, still struggle with the fact that we seem still be within, you know, testing first or testing last, and teachers. And, you know, I wonder if there's somebody who has a comment about, you know, places that have broken that mold and are teaching in a very different way, or are looking at this whole education model in a very different way.
Part of what I'm thinking of is the kind of models that would challenge the traditional notion of how teachers are educated. I do think that NGOs in education, international NGOs, should play a role in the ministries of education, should be at schools, and that the assessments that are currently underway take into consideration side by side with the PISA and the rankings. I wouldn't bury those. I would keep them side by side so that the debate can flourish. But that when you come from a different perspective, you're an NGO inside of a school of ed, or you're a school of ed, you're an NGO inside of a corporation, that we actually do some blurring of the lines of organizations to allow for people to make these changes that would emerge, so that you can figure out ways to reach the people who reach the people.
Part of this, though, that I think hasn't been touched on enough is perhaps the need to localize. That to some extent, the people who know what skills they need are going to be the ones developing the skills, and they can see from their local context if industry or social fabric is different in their part of the country or part of the world. It's very hard for big centralized decision making to guide that for you.
You know, I don't think that's the way we define equity, and that's not the way that we should define equity. Equity is not about everybody doing the same in math and science and reading and geography. Equity is about ensuring that success doesn't depend on the socioeconomic context from which students come and which schools work. And that is a very important objective. You do not want that gender drives the ability of math, or that gender or that social background drives your success in math. And that's really what we should expect from a good education system. And actually, that's what we see in the best performing education systems in the world. Whether you look to Asia, whether you look to Finland and Europe, they actually do succeed to enable all young people to reach their talent and to reach their potential. They don't end up the same score in every subject, in every test, but they have the success not depending on the socioeconomic context.
One of the things, though, that has depressed me about getting back into a closer involvement in education in the last year, after being travelling the world rather a lot with the council, has been that I've returned to a debate that we were having 20, 25 years ago when I first knew Adrian, or more than that, Adrian, because I think we still seem to be talking about the need for a new paradigm for education. We were talking about that 25, 30 years ago, and we don't seem to have moved on. And that I find a little bit depressing.
What's happened in other sectors that have embraced innovation is they talk about things like inverting the pyramid, driving innovation to the front line, that the people who actually feel the bumps in the road should be the people driving the car. So if we sort of agree that, because that seems to be the difference, the potential difference about where we might be now and where we have been for the long amount of time that we're talking about this. I'm sort of trying to have a kind of thought experiment, which is, what would a solution to all this look like that had no role for policymakers? That we didn't start from an assumption. The way we do all of this is change some policy and extrude that out into the system. What would a model that just simply took policymakers out of the system look like?
I think one thing that's come through for me into the discussion is the need to perhaps get to grips a little bit more with what schools are expected to do, what teachers are expected to do, as opposed to say what government may do or what others should do. I think I know that we can't expect schools to do everything. We can't expect every teacher in every school to understand the world of work and therefore the skills gaps they may well be educating young people towards. I think that's where partnerships are really important.
we can get remote trainers who are the very best teachers teaching teachers remotely over video conferencing, over virtual classroom technology, and we teach students who don't have teachers that way by using the community to be the to look after the students and to facilitate them. So I think there are ways in which we can do this, and there are answers to some of the questions we posed today.
Okay, well, that is a really good point to make, but I think it's not as simple as saying that private schools do better because they pay their teachers more and they get better teachers. And my experience has been that it can actually be the opposite. You look at Punjab is a good example, has exactly the opposite. The low-cost private schools pay less money to their teachers, and yet they get better results. It is true, people pull their children out of school because they don't see any value in it. And you see that in eastern Nigeria, where actually the children, the boys get taken out to go and trade in the market with their fathers. The girls go on and complete education and get degrees. So you get illiterate boys marrying graduate girls. Quite the opposite of what you expect most parts of the world.
I partly agree that we're still having the same debate we've been having year after year after year, but I do think there are some changes that are taking place. They've already been identified. There is more attention to actually real partnerships, not just made-up partnerships. There is more use of technology. There is more attention to outcomes, not just measuring not useful things. And I think there's better sharing of best practice. To me, these all give some hope.